Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is Now or Never. And that debt is fraud. And we are wrapping up the Massachusetts debates. So that's a good thing. So that we can move forward, we just basically got, let me see, South Carolina, Virginia. And South Carolina won't take too long because it's 137 pages. And their focus is really on the slavery side. So that we'll be dealing with mostly that. But then we'll get into Virginia. And Virginia is probably the longest because it was the most vigorously debated. I think it is the longest in pages. New York is actually second, but it seems like there's just more anti-federalists in the New York debates because there was hardly support for it. And Hamilton understood this. That's why I kept on, you know, telling you folks that Hamilton was just buying time, because if Virginia ratified, he knew New York would go. I mean, I think there were a lot of anti-federalists that said, well, if Virginia ratifies, then we have to go because we just can't let them set the tone, because if this really takes off, they'll actually have control over how things start. Now, this is worth noting. Understanding at the very beginning of setting the pace, setting the direction, setting the demeanor, the tone, whatever you want to call it, for getting things laid down first, being involved in that is important. So much so that Hamilton proves it, because Jefferson was gone. I've pointed this out before, but when Jefferson had not come back, but Washington wanted him to be the Secretary of State, well, Hamilton, already being there, becoming the Secretary of the Treasury, he just took it upon himself to kind of, well, I'll take care of this for Jefferson. And he laid out the responsibilities, granting the Department of Treasury far more powers than they should have had. And he basically trimmed down things that should have probably been given to the Secretary or the State Department instead of the Treasury. And so Jefferson was, I don't want to say he was impressed in a good way. He was impressed in the right way, that this guy was a little maniacal weasel, that you couldn't trust this guy. You give him an inch and you'll take a mile, and that's exactly what he did. But anyway, as we wrap up the Massachusetts debates, as we kind of covered what Mr. Stillman, and as a matter of fact, what Sean had just finished reading, this last part needs to just be ran over one more time, because we ran out of time. Throughout this, and you hear me say this, and these are the framers, folks, telling you that it is our responsibility to hold our government in check and accountability. Now, there's the elections and so forth. He even actually mentioned the word interposition at the very beginning of this. As a matter of fact, I believe it was in the very beginning where the usage of the word interposition was used. Maybe I'm wrong on that. Where was it? Impeachment. Did you see the word interposition? Sean, do you remember seeing it?
No, I do not.
Okay. Yes, in the Electoral College part. It basically says the president and the senators are to be chosen by the interposition of the legislatures of the several states, who are the representatives and guardians of the people, whose honor and interest will lead them in all human probability to have good men placed in the general government. So that was the first time that the word... in a second time it was used. There's only twice it was used here, but nevertheless, they used that word of interposing, because the senators were to determine the process the state legislature was to determine the place, manner, and time of how the electors were to be chosen. So anyway, the very last part of this, after all, if this Constitution, this is his final comments and what Sean read yesterday, After all, if this Constitution was as perfect as the sacred volume is, it would be not secure the liberty. It would not secure the liberties of the people unless they watch their own liberties. Nothing written on paper will do this. It is therefore necessary that the people should keep a watchful, not a jealous eye on their rulers, and that they should give all due encouragement of our colleges, schools of learning, etc., so that knowledge may be diffused, disseminated through every part of the country. By doing this, then everybody should understand what they should be doing, and as long as everybody knows what they're supposed to do and what they can do, then it keeps them in check. Ah, but if they pervert what, you know, they start saying, oh, no, we can do these things, and we can do this, and we can do this, and they get away with that, then it the aggrandizing of their power will never end. And this is where we are today, folks. We need to hold them accountable to the very few powers that they're to have. The idea, and I mentioned this yesterday, the idea that a dean could actually get away with saying, well, they've been doing it for 100 years, 50 years, it doesn't matter what the duration is. Why, you know, there's no point in changing now. It's working. No. It is a violation, and it becomes the basis of the next violation, the basis of the next violation. Holding them fully accountable to the few powers is what must be done, or we'll never get this back. Never. So, at the very end of this, of the ratification debates of Massachusetts, you'll actually find that there are these more recommended amendments notes down underneath the Commonwealth on page 126. Do you see those?
I see, yes. Okay. More recommended amendments?
Yes. Okay. So these are what actually makes it in to what they're going to attach with the ratification as a formal recommendation of amendments. So let's go ahead and go through these. And I say these are more because John Hancock kind of proposed before what he thought recommended amendments would be. And then there were some few more that were added. These are those that were added to that. So let's go ahead and do these.
First, that it be explicitly declared that all powers not expressly delegated by the aforesaid Constitution are reserved to the several states to be by them exercised.
Okay.
Secondly, that there shall be one representative to every 30,000 persons according to the census mentioned in the Constitution until the whole number of representatives amounts to 200. Thirdly, that the Congress do not exercise the power vested in them by the fourth section of the first article, but in cases where a state shall neglect or refuse to make the regulation therein mentioned, or shall make regulations subversive of the rights of the people to a free and equal representation in Congress, agreeably to the Constitution. Fourthly, that the Congress do not lay direct taxes, but when the monies arising from the imposts and excise are insufficient for the public exigencies, nor then until Congress shall have first made a requisition upon the states to assess, levy, and pay their respective portion of such requisitions, agreeably to the census fixed in the said Constitution, in such way and manner as the legislatures of the states shall think best, and in such case, if any state shall neglect or refuse to pay its proportion pursuant to such requisition, then Congress may assess and levy such states' proportion together with interest thereon at the rate of 6% per annum from the time of payment prescribed in such requisitions. Fifthly, that Congress erect no company with exclusive advantage of commerce. Sixthly, that no person shall be tried for any crime by which he may incur an infamous punishment or loss of life until he be first indicted by a grand jury, except in such cases that may arise in the government and regulation of the land and naval forces. Seventhly, the Supreme Judicial Federal Court shall have no jurisdiction of causes between citizens of different states, unless the matter in dispute, whether it concern the realty or personality, be of the value of $3,000 at the least. Nor shall the federal judicial powers extend to any action between citizens of different states, where the matter in dispute, whether it concern the realty or personality, is not of the value of $1,500 at the least. Eighthly, in civil action between citizens of different states, every issue of fact arising in actions at common law shall be tried by a jury if the parties or either of them request it. Ninthly, Congress shall at no time consent that any person holding an office of trust or profits under the United States shall accept the title of nobility or any other title or office from any king, prince, or foreign state.
Okay, so two things I wanted to do a go back on. The first one was this representation. It was the second recommended amendment, that there should be one representative to every 30,000 persons. That was actually included in the Pennsylvania debates. And some of these are kind of similar, but that one right there was included. And I don't know if everybody remembers, but we covered the recommended amendments out of Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was the first shot in doing this, but it wasn't big news, and I don't know why it wasn't big news out of Pennsylvania, but apparently these guys, or Massachusetts, must have got a copy of what came out of Pennsylvania and said, you know what, we're going to do this. And I think just because it was a formality of getting across the finish line, that's why most all the other states afterwards started recommending amendments, which is one of the reasons why we kind of gave you some insights to some of those states that didn't debate it. They just provided recommended amendments. And they were all very much similar. In other words, not a lot of, you know, originality and authorship and so forth. Now, the last thing I want to share with you is the numbers. Now, it says the analysis of the ratification by G.R. Mobley. These are the actual numbers of each of the different counties. There are a total of 13 different counties. Now, if you add up the counties that ratified the Constitution, it was done by 62%. If you add up by popular vote, the popular vote was much closer. Do you see my point? In other words, the popular vote, the ratification was only by 53%. Let me ask you folks, if you required an amendment, the ratification of an amendment in your state to be done by popular vote or by county, there would probably be a very hard time for a popular vote, because you may actually have 60% of the people of the state that do not want a really good amendment to be passed. You know, but the red counties will come in and say, yeah, we want to keep them from being able to do that, you know, such as abortion. You would probably have, you know, 39, if there were 60 counties and almost 40 of the counties, 39 counties were conservative or red, you would have a 39 to 21. That would be a pretty overwhelming ratification of not allowing abortion. Does that make sense? Sean?
I like it. Oh, okay. I like it.
All right. So this is one of the reasons why every state constitution needs to be changed. I'm just giving you the facts that when you really look at holding things in the context of the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution, requiring 3/4 of the states for a ratification of an amendment, why did we allow mob rule to change our constitutions at the state level? Did we not have a high regard for the law that we created? Or did we just, you know, we wanted to be more susceptible to the whims and desires of the people, you know, to be trendy. Oh, well, everybody else is doing it. Let's do that too. This is one of the key things that I just really wanted to point out that when we really look at, you know, how this, the ratification of this one in Massachusetts, because Massachusetts was, it was one of the early ones, and it was a, I'll just say that it seemed to be a lot of anti-federalists. There was even these ploys of, if you remember, the emergency, they had to stop and say, hey, there's rumor that, you know, somebody's pouring money in to try to influence the convention here. Remember that?
Yes, sir.
This is the only ratification where that kind of occurred. But the point is that, and as a matter of fact, let me even include this. It was so close of a ratification that President Hancock had to basically get up and, you know, basically, I don't want to say interpose, but he had to inject himself and say, look, I'm really concerned that we may not pass this. And I think that what we need to do is consider these amendments, and he threw these amendments out. And I think that's what really changed it. And if you actually go through the voting and all of that, which is just above this, I believe, if you just actually kind of, I think I might have highlighted Samuel Adams. Did I? I may not have. No, I don't see it. But they have all the names here of all the people that voted. And if you look for Samuel Adams, he ratified. There's people out there, sovereign citizens and other different patriots who are very, they have, you know, not so favorable things to say about the ratification. They glorify the anti-federalists and so forth. That is absolute. The Federalists at this point in time were purists. They were looking at the Constitution and they were basically saying this is exactly what it means. It wasn't until Hamilton used corruption to convert and basically corrupt the Federalist Party, which forced Jefferson and Madison to actually create the Republican Party in 1792. This is where, you know, they divided, and now the nation actually had two separate parties. And they didn't use the Republican Party, you know, they didn't really mobilize and get it out there until 1799. And for one, it took 1 year. They had 1 year to do it, and they succeeded because it was Jefferson and Madison's party. So that's what that type of influence. You got a rock star. You got somebody that is, you know, the hero, the subject matter expert, like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Then, yeah, you're going to have that kind of an outcome in changing the direction politically, because these are the SMEs, the subject matter experts of politics of America, more so than Hamilton, because Hamilton was never, I mean, what did Hamilton do? Hamilton was that little, he was the peanut in the gallery. So, but he was the key instigator. He was the key, you know, manipulator. He was the guy that was connected and was bringing money and utilizing these, I'll just say, these nefarious arguments to move and get people to go down the path he wanted them to go. So anyway, let's wrap this up. Anything to go back on? Any other comments or any gee whizzes or wows or I can't believes?
Not really.
Fair enough. So one last thing I need to do to clean this up. I want to get rid of that stopped. And there we go. My last stopped here. And I'm saving this. So folks, this is the first one that I've actually added extra comments. And so when I post this, you'll actually see that there's highlights, and then you'll see my commentary, like to raise and support armies. And I will, you know, I have these other comments to add to that. So that way, I'm not changing the text or inserting things into the text. I'm actually using commentary. So anyway, I'm going to be doing that for the next four debates. I didn't do that with Pennsylvania. I'm sorry. I will next year. I'm going to start doing that, because while Sean's reading and commenting, that's, you know, as I go, you know, this needs to be expounded and I need to add this comment. And so that's, I'm just trying to make these things better to help people recognize those points, to highlight them so that you can look at them in that same light. Does that help? I hope it helps.
Yes, sir.
With that said, with that said, let's get into the Honorable Mr. Pinckney. Now, currently, the way we're looking at this, all of the highlights are indents, so they're, you know, the Honorable Mr. Pinckney starts talking, and then he talks about the Articles of Confederation, the importance of the equal suffrage, blah, 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 blah. So we're going to start off at the very kind of top of this, and actually, you'll notice that none of these conventions mention a challenge to the commissions, not even in Virginia. And I believe that that was a play that the Anti-Federalists, because Pauline Maier, in her, she wrote a book on the ratification debates, and she basically mentioned that in these heavily contested debates, that there was a pause before they did anything formal, because there were people, there was enough noise by the Anti-Federalists to say, we have a right to determine whether they violated their commission or not, because if they did, we should not ratify this. And so they convinced, you know, the leadership of the convention to pause the convention or the ratification process to determine whether they were going to move forward or not. And I know in Virginia, she mentioned that that happened in Virginia. It may have happened in South Carolina, but I doubt it. You know why I doubt it? Because South Carolina needed to stay in this. I think the majority of the Anti-Federalists were just concerned with the shutting down of the slave trade and those types of things, because you're going to see this. They knew they got what they needed so that they could maintain their dominance in commerce. So the Carolinas and Georgia, interestingly enough, North Carolina just chose not to ratify. They paused for a year just to make sure that things didn't go sideways against slavery. And they go, oh, okay, it seems like, you know, we're going to get what we're going to get. Because slavery was the key issue for Carolina. Well, actually, you're going to find North Carolina had a little bit, you know, broader debate on it. But South Carolina was pretty focused on slavery. And Georgia, shoot, it was a slam dunk for them. They just said, we know we need this. They were a small state anyway. They didn't have nearly the affluence that South Carolina and North Carolina even more. So the more affluence, the more independence or power you're giving up. And but so that's why you kind of see the little gauge that South Carolina needed to come into the Union far more than North Carolina did. That's one of the reasons why they paused. But anyway, enough said. I don't want to be repeating myself, and I think somehow I am. And we've got about 1 minute before we go into break. So now might be a good time to just turn the time over to you, Sean, to, you know, if you want to expound on anything or questions or anything like that. I'm just smiling here because
yes, yeah, kind of leave me hanging at the end there.
So eventually you'll become so passionate over all these different principles and so forth that 1 minute won't be enough to actually just, you know, to clear the air, to share all of these things. And you go, well, I only got a minute. Well, okay, then it gets frustrating to try to cram it in there. I don't know. Some people say it's the gift of gab. I don't think so. I don't believe it's necessarily the gift of gab. I believe that as older people get older, it's not that they learn the gift of gab, that they become learned. And those who are willing to share, then they are more than, and that's why older people usually say a lot. They usually are sharing and so forth. That's why, you know, at family gatherings, people, you know, grandma and grandpa, you know, talk and everybody listens. Now, they don't just talk to take up all the time, but what they do have to say is kind of E.F. Hutton level. So when we come back, I'll just kind of wrap up on the E.F. Hutton level, because people recognize that they're speaking with wisdom. People recognize that this isn't just some whimsical, you know, ideas. There are, you know, lessons learned and, you know, profound understanding behind what they're saying. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. E.F. Hutton. Now, E.F. Hutton, when E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen. Now, when I started doing radio, I was not just the guy first time getting behind a microphone. I spent a long time, and when I mean a long time, about 30 plus, almost 35 years in the intelligence community, folks. And so when I started in the intelligence community, one of the things you got to do is you got to brief. And if you're the subject matter expert on something, then you really have to brief, and it's expected of you. And there's been many a times when, you know, there was really very little that I knew about something, but because I was the Emmett guy is a part of the staff on the MAU or the MU, because the first time we went out was a MAU, the second time we went out was a MU, because we were actually on the first MU created, a Marine Expeditionary Unit, before it was a Marine Amphibious Unit. And so there's times when you're just standing there. There's nothing you have to say. But all of a sudden, the commanding general will say, or the, not the, yeah, let me see. No, the CO, which is a colonel at the MU, of the MU and the MAU was a colonel, not a general. But I've had even generals when they, you know, Mobley, what do you have to say about that? And you know what? Sometimes you have to say, you know, find these things interesting, but I don't understand them, so I'll have to look it up and I'll have to get back to you. I mean, that's the smartest thing. If you really don't know, you admit to it. Don't make it up, because too many times you'll eat those words. And sometimes I've seen people, I'll just share this really quick. If you've ever seen message traffic, and have you ever seen message traffic, Sean? Military message traffic, where they got all the routing stuff at the very, very top.
Correct.
And that all that routing stuff is a bunch of letters that actually make no words. It's like several lines sometimes, depending on how much routing is being done for this message to go out. And if it's a big message, and then like a huge alert or something like that, then there's a lot of messages or a lot of routing at the very, very top. And all of a sudden, a clerk comes in, and this was at Third Ma when it was at El Toro, not at Miramar. And this sergeant comes in with... And I was involved in this briefing, and a sergeant comes in with this critical, you know, message, and he comes in, and the general, you know, pauses, because every time he comes in, there's a reason, and he's got a paper in his hand. And at this point in time, there's a lieutenant. This actually was a second lieutenant that was, you know, kind of doing the general brief for the day, because everybody kind of, they take turns. The staff takes turns in doing the general brief. And I not mean the general's brief. It's just the overall brief of the day, and then everybody gives very specific things of pertinent information. And and I was there to provide pertinent information. And I was a sergeant at that point in time, too. And so anyway, this sergeant walks in with this critical, and the general goes, "What's up?" And he goes, "I've a critical message, sir, needs to be read." And so he hands it to the second lieutenant. And the second lieutenant is looking at this, and he doesn't know what, you know, he doesn't know where the message starts, because there's that much routing material. And this is not a huge room, the huge auditorium or anything like that. And so, you know, he's looking and looking, and the general goes, just read it from the top. And so he starts reading the and, you know, at that point, the general gets up out of his chair, grabs the paper out of his hand, just starts reading it and goes, and needless to say, that lieutenant did not have a good brief that day. Just because you get rattled and stuff like that. But after you've been shell-shocked or, you know, the spotlight been put on you and those types of things, over time you get used to it. And actually, what I'm saying here is, over time, when you actually have read so much and you can start connecting dots and you can, it gets it easier and easier to actually, you know, share, you know, your feelings, you know, to share a testimony or your conviction on, you know, how important these things are, that type of stuff. You know, it takes a little while. You know, how long have we been doing this? Has it been a year yet? It's almost a year now, right?
Yes, sir.
When did you start? Was it July last year or was it June?
I do not have that information at this moment, sir.
You know,
they all kind of blend together.
You know, so I think you came in after the ratification debates. I think the first thing we did was the Assumption Act together. So that may have been maybe July, August timeframe. So it's almost been a year. And great play. All right. So let's start off with the Articles of Confederation and Mr. Charles Pinckney, because remember, folks, we went through the Constitutional Convention and he was there. That both Pinckneys, either it was General or Colonel Pinckney, the rank Pinckney, and then Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. And this is Charles Cotesworth Pinckney. Go ahead.
It must be recollected that upon the conclusion of the definitive treaty, great inconveniences were experienced as resulting from the inefficacy of the Confederation. The one first and most sensibly felt was the destruction of our commerce, occasioned by the restrictions of other nations, whose policy it was not in the power of the general government to counteract. The loss of credit, the inability in our citizens to pay taxes, and the languor of our government were, as they ever must be, the certain consequences of the decay of commerce. Frequent and unsuccessful attempts were made by Congress to obtain the necessary powers. The states, too, individually attempted, by navigation acts and other commercial provisions, to remedy the evil. These, instead of correcting, served but to increase it. Their regulations interfered not only with each other, but in almost every instance with treaties existing under the authority of the Union. Hence arose the necessity of some general and permanent system which should at once embrace all interests and, by placing the states upon firm united ground, enable them effectually to assert their commercial rights. Sensible that nothing but a concert of measures could effect this, Virginia proposed a meeting of commissioners at Annapolis from the legislature of each state, who should be empowered to take into consideration the commerce of the Union, to consider how far a uniform system in their commercial regulation might be necessary to the common interest, and to report to the states such an act as, when unanimously ratified by them, would enable Congress effectually to provide for the same. In consequence of this, 10 states appointed delegates. By accident or otherwise, they did not attend, only 5 states being represented. The gentlemen present, not being a majority of the Union, did not conceive it advisable to proceed, but in an address to their constituents, which was also transmitted to the other legislatures, acquainted them with the circumstances of their meeting, that there appeared to them to be other and more material defects in the federal system than merely those of commercial powers, that these, upon examination, might be found greater than even the acts of their appointments implied, was at least so far probable from the embarrassments which marked the present state of national affairs, foreign and domestic, as to merit in their opinions a deliberate and candid discussion in some mode which would unite the sentiments and counsels of all the states. They therefore suggested the appointment of another convention under more extensive powers, for the purpose of devising such further provisions as should appear to them necessary to render the federal government adequate to the exigencies of the union. And that's pretty much what each one of those said, too. Under this recommendation, the late convention assembled, for most of the appointments had been made before the recommendation of Congress was formed or known. He thought proper concisely to mention the manner of conventions assembling, merely to obviate an objection which all the opposers of the federal system had used, vis-a-vis that at that time of the convention met, no opinion was entertained of their departing from the Confederation, that merely the grant of commercial powers and establishment of federal revenue were in agitation, whereas nothing can be more true than that its promoters had for their object a firm national government. Those who had seriously contemplated the subject were fully convinced that a total change of the system was necessary, that however the repair of the Confederation might for a time avert the inconveniences of a dissolution, it was impossible a government of that sort could long unite this growing and extensive country. They also thought that the public mind was fully prepared for the change, and that no time could be more proper for introducing it than the present, that the total want of government, the destruction of commerce, of public credit, private confidence, and national character were surely sufficiently alarming to awaken their constituents to a true sense of their situation. Under these momentous impressions, the convention met, when the first question that naturally presented itself to the view of almost every member, although it was never formally brought forward, was the formation of a new or the amendment of the existing system. Whatever might have been the opinions of a few speculative men who either did or pretended to confide more in the virtue of the people than prudence warranted, Mr. Pinckney said he would venture to assert that the states were unanimous in preferring a change. They wisely considered that, though the Confederation might possess the great outlines of a general government, yet that it was, in fact, nothing more than a federal union, or, strictly speaking, a league founded in paternal and persuasive principles, with nothing permanent and coercive in its construction, where the members might or might not comply with their federal engagements as they thought proper, that no power existed of raising supplies but by the requisitions or quotas on the states, that this defect had been almost fatally evinced by the experience in states for the last 6 or 8 years, in which not one of them had completely complied, but a few had even paid up their specie proportions, others very partially, and some, he had every reason to believe, had not to this day contributed a shilling to the common treasury since the Union was formed. He should not go into a detail of the conduct of the states or the unfortunate and embarrassing situation to which they had been so often and so strongly represented by Congress, he was sure there could not be a member on the floor unacquainted with them. It was sufficient to remark that the convention saw and felt the necessity of establishing a government upon different principles, which, instead of requiring the intervention of 13 different legislatures between the demand and the compliance, should operate upon the people in the first instance. He repeated that the necessity of having a government which should at once operate upon the people and not upon the states was conceived to be indispensable by every delegation present, that however they may have differed with respect to the quantum of power, no objection was made to the system itself. They considered it, however, highly necessary that in the establishment of a constitution possessing extensive national authorities, a proper distribution of its powers should be attended to. Sensible of the danger of a single body, and that to such a council the states ought not to entrust important rights, they considered it their duty to divide the legislature into two branches, and by a limited revisionary power, to mingle in some degree the executive in their proceedings, a provision that he was pleased to find meets with universal approbation. The degree of weight with each state was to have in the federal council became a question of much agitation. The larger states contended that no government could long exist whose principles were founded in injustice, that one of the most serious and unanswerable objections to the present system was the injustice of its tendency in allowing each state an equal vote, notwithstanding their striking disparity.
Okay, so what you didn't know is there was a minor loss in comms for probably a few seconds. So, folks, you didn't hear Sean. I didn't hear Sean, but Sean kept reading and he didn't know, which is okay. I'm letting you know that the pause that you hear, because I usually delete the gaps and so forth to kind of compress time, but that little gap in time, you know, if you're reading along, that gives you the appropriate time to keep with the pace and reading the words. So anyway, if those types of things happen, that's one of the reasons why I leave those gaps in there. But anyhow, now the importance on equal suffrage. But actually, as you stated and you pointed out, that he just covered the whole dispute of whether they fulfilled their duty as their commission of delegates to go and deal with the exigencies of the union. Because clearly it wasn't about just going and fixing commerce. That there was clearly this problem that was dealing with the public credit, the problem with the commerce and the trade, navigation, all of these different things that were literally having this adverse effect. He even went into this concept of species, and I believe they're going to dive into this even more, because he talks about, you know, how not even one state even paid a shilling. So the point is that, you know, he's covering this, I'll just say, why these conventions actually did happen, why they moved forward, because nobody could argue that the Articles of Confederation were inept and impotent, that they needed a government that could at least do what they empowered it to do. If not, then there's the point in having a government is, you know, useless if you're not going to give it the power to do what it needs to do. Okay, so let's go into the importance of equal suffrage.
The small ones replied, and perhaps with reason, that as the states were the pillars upon which the general government must ever rest, their state governments must remain, that however they may vary in point of territory or population, as political associations, they were equal, that upon these terms they formally confederated, and that no inducement whatsoever should tempt them to unite upon others, that if they did, it would amount to nothing less than throwing the whole government of the Union into the hands of three or four of the largest states.
Okay, so let me pause you there. That was the foundation of keeping the small states in the Union. The solution wasn't truly just equal suffrage in the Senate. It was dividing the roles and responsibilities so that the things that really mattered to the states, i.e. the trade agreements, so that the states would be able to develop, nurture themselves, develop, you know, and expand their breadth of commerce and, you know, productivity and so forth. So the Senate was given those responsibilities that mattered to it. And then the House of Representatives was given those roles and responsibilities that mattered to the people, like going to war, paying the taxes, those types of things. This is how they actually made this. If you want to call it a compromise, but to me, this was divine. Give to the party that has the interest. Give to the stakeholder that has the interest. Let's just back up. I've said this before when we talked about education a long time ago. Why is it that the employers or the people that are going to employ these children coming out of the education system have no say in what they're learning when they're the ones that actually they're going to, you know, employ them for the next 20, 30, 40 years? You know, hey, how about giving them more math because they're coming here with dismal math skills? They're coming here without any understanding of, you know, this. And so the where the work is being done They are the stakeholders. They're the recipients of the education system. They should have some say. And it's the same thing here as you start understanding who should have these roles and responsibilities. You know, are those people that actually are going to have to deal with the problem, i.e. the state legislatures should have the roles and responsibilities of that Senate or have that control, that suffrage, and be able to have those senators representing them instead of the people, because their interests were different. So this bicameral legislation, this was a divine feature that was injected in. These men didn't even realize while it was being suggested and so forth, it just kind of helped. You know, all these small states cared about is that they had their equal suffrage. If without that, they wouldn't be in the system. Instead of actually seeing the grander picture to go, wow, this is better. Letting the people have their say and letting us have our say over those things that matter. Hopefully that makes sense. Hopefully what I just said makes sense, because this truly was the divine hand of providence, because they didn't recognize it at the time. And they didn't ever put it into that context like I am right now. Nobody, I've never seen it really laid in context to help everybody understand that it was just right. Give to the father those things that are important, you know, in teaching his son or to his children, those lessons that he needs to teach, and give to the mother her ability to do those things that is important for her to teach her children, instead of, you know, stifling one and only having one. Because it's far more divine that the child gets, you know, the instruction from both, because both are pertinent, even though you'd never get, 9 times out of 10, you'll never get the instructions from the mother that would have ever came from the father, and vice versa. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So what is really, I just feel compelled to try to emphasize, folks, please try to start looking at this as much more than just these little lanes in the road. This was divine, because it actually created a system that would operate and function at a higher degree than anything we ever had. It's kind of like a marriage where the husband and wife are truly, they have a symbiotic and a synergistic relationship, and they have a household that is operating on, you know, at 100% capacity. You know, when you're at your optimum level, that means that you're not being dragged down because of contention and because of problems or a lack thereof of support, because, you know, you're a widower or you're a widow. Nobody wants to be in those situations. Everybody would like to have their spouse. Everybody would like to have that other. And when you look at Congress, it shouldn't be contention between the two houses. It should be symbiotic and synergistic. That one has one very specific and divine role like the husband, and one has a very specific and divine role like the mother. And the same with the Senate and the House of Representatives. And let me just, I think I just hit it enough to get everybody to start looking at this bicameral legislative body, because this is what we should have applied at the state level, and we didn't understand. This only proves how little we understood moving forward, because when we look at the states, how screwed up they are. Hopefully that makes sense too. Hopefully that all kind of connects everything. All right, so go ahead and continue. I apologize.
No problem, sir. okay, after much anxious discussion, for had the convention separated without determining upon a plan, it would have been on this point. A compromise was effected by which it was determined that the first branch be so chosen as to represent in due proportion the people of the Union, that the Senate should be the representative of the states, where each should have an equal weight. Though he was at first opposed to the compromise, yet he was far from thinking it an injudicious one. The different branches of the legislature being intended as checks upon each other, it appeared to him they would be more effectually restrain their mutual intemperances under this mode of representation than they would have done if both houses had been so formed upon proportional principles. for let us theorize as much as we will, it would be impossible so far to divest the majority of the federal representatives of their state views and policy as to induce them always to act upon truly national principles. Men do not easily wean themselves of those preferences and attachments which country and connections invariably create, and it must frequently have happened had the larger states acquired that decided majority which a proportional representation would have given them in both houses, that state views and policy would have influenced their deliberations. The ease with which they would, upon all occasions, have secured a majority in legislature might, in times less virtuous than the present, have operated as temptation to designing and ambitious men to sacrifice the public good to private views. This cannot be the case at present. The different mode of representation for the Senate will, as has already been observed, most effectually prevent it. And that's why they changed it.
So he kind of basically...
I added that last part.
Yeah, I get that. But he kind of basically said what I got into a little more detail regarding this divine nature of letting those who have these very divine responsibilities over, you know, the governing of the people. I mean, these states, these counties were created by the people to govern them. And they gave them very specific powers. If you don't allow them to govern in the capacity that they were asked to by the people, then you're basically just, you're killing yourself. And what you're doing is you're creating a system that no longer is serving the people. And so because again, the state legislature is created by the counties as well as the people, bicameral. Today, that's what we have. Maybe back then it was all created by the people, but regardless, as we have expounded and grown into this new concept of governing, now we can actually see bicameral the advantage of that state legislature having the wisdom from the House of Representatives as well as the state Senate working and creating their own symbiosis and synergy, like a husband and wife. We need to do that at the county level as well. We may not need to have a Senate. Larger counties do. Larger populated counties need to have a Senate as well as a representative body because there are different interests that that county needs to really address. The needs of the people as well as the needs of the commerce and keeping the economy and those things moving that the people don't appreciate or understand, nor should they. That's why we've created that government. So the point is that I'm just highlighting it one more time, that it is divine to allow, you know, these types of relationships to actually be encouraged, fostered, to ensure that symbiosis, mutually benefiting relationships develop, and that synergy develops in the context of serving those who create government. When we create government as the sovereigns of all, of, you know, when it comes to government, when we create that government, we're creating sovereigns to govern us by our own consent. And so this is a very critical lesson and a very critical perspective that we need to maintain. That's why I've added it to the notes here. Anyway, I'm Jerry Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. And God bless you. And thank you so much, Sean, for all your work. I really appreciate it. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.